Hello and welcome, Andreas Hottinger.
Hi.
Welcome everybody back to this podcast series, Let's Talk Value in Healthcare, where I'm talking in loose sequence to any one of the five P's: patients, providers, physicians, pharma, payer, and policymakers. So it's a pleasure today to have Dr. Andreas Hottinger as a physician, as we're thinking about and talking what are all the things that are not going straight in healthcare right now, because we know we had phenomenal innovation in medicine and science over the past 2-3 decades, but we also have increasingly an issue of affordability. And we also see with the current pandemic, with all the gaps and flaws we have in our systems and can't even get basic material like masks and gowns. So somehow in this industry, the number of things don't go right and we have to fix them. And there's a number of really motivated and talented people like Andreas, who I'm sure after 20, 30 years in healthcare has plenty of ideas on what we can do differently moving forward. So Andreas holds a double board certificate. He's both a neurologist and a medical oncologist. And he's as strong in the clinics with patients as he is in research, holding an MD, PhD. He trained in Switzerland and in the US, in New York, and now is an attending physician in one of the major university hospitals in Europe. So with further ado, Andreas, I'd like to dive in and ask you a little bit around when we talk about value, what, like very spontaneously, what does it mean to you in your daily life in the clinics? And maybe you want to link it with where frustrations are, because it's not because we want to complain, but sometimes it's easier to understand what it should be when we talk about what's a little bit broken in your daily lives.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not sure to start saying that everything is broken is the right way to start. I think there are a number of things that actually do work and do work quite amazingly well. And if you take back the COVID story now, since you mentioned that before, it's true that it was extremely complicated to get masks, to get gowns at the very beginning. But it's also impressive how everything changed and how we were able to turn around. I mean, don't forget that, you know, masks were needed for a small minority of people. I mean, mostly physicians and nurses. And then suddenly you had to have masks for absolutely everybody. And it took, what, about 3 months to be able to come around. So it's also a sign of how quickly you can actually induce changes in the system. And I think that's an important point to raise at the beginning. And then maybe continue with COVID also. I mean, it's interesting to see the parallels, because we're also always saying, you know, it's amazing, you need huge progress, computers, artificial intelligence is going to be able to change everything, we're going to find new molecules that work like crazy. And I think to me, one of the big lessons of this COVID crisis is that in the end, we stayed with mostly very good doctors being able to care of the patients and good old steroids working for the patients, much more than all the new promising drug, much more than hydroxychloroquine that came and went as quickly, much more than bleach and so on. I mean, obviously we stayed with very old drugs, and it's also a sign of, you know, how important the basic things are, and your basic medical knowledge is to be able to manage patients. And then on the other side, you see these massive progresses that have happened with vaccines. I mean, it's really impressive to see that, you know, something that was a concept before COVID, which was RNA vaccination, had never really been proven in any disease, suddenly able to run around and be actually able to, we hope, make the difference in the next few months. And this is, when you think about it, it's a disease that almost nobody knew a year ago about it. So it's very, very impressive. And it's also a sign, and it's not because we have cut corners with the science. It's also really because suddenly all the steps have been condensed and shortened to a maximum. And I hope that this is going to be one of the lessons, not only for COVID, but for every single disease, is that you do not need 10 years to develop a new medication. If you cut all the administrative steps with a drug that's extremely promising, you can make an absolute huge difference in much, much quicker time than we used to do. And to me,
phenomenal. And thank you for your optimism. And I think that is inherent with with a really good doctor and a good cancer doctor. It's like we need to keep the hope up and the positive side, and the glass is half full. And I fully agree. I think COVID has shown all the phenomenal sides as well, and how quickly we can change and innovate. The thing is, for some reason, before that global crisis, an economic crisis, by the way, we did not change. And as you say, RNA, you know, science was there before, but it never was really picked up for vaccines. And so somehow we seem to need that disaster and crisis to really move forward. And then, but it's true, we did it and it went really fast, and great innovation, and a vaccine within less than 12 months, unheard of. So I think it's great. So what are the things that we could perpetuate if you think about your clinical daily life with patients in the provider circuit? You know, what are some of the things you would love to see we learn from this crisis and that we take on and maintain for your daily living in general clinics?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to start small and very, very practical things, and then expand a little bit. But if you look at very practical, I mean, the most above thing that you have as a doctor is obviously all the paperwork that needs to be done today. And this at every single level. I mean, it can be linked to the hospital, meaning that setting up an appointment or finding a bed for a patient is a complete hassle. It takes hours to be able to organize that and so on. But this is something that normally should be able to be resolved quite quickly if your hospital puts the means into it. Another level, if you go a little bit further, is how do you get access to medications? I work in a field that's brain tumors. It's exclusively rare disorders. So it's excessively rare that you actually have data available for your own patients, meaning that in many, many situations, we are relying on data or information that has been gathered for other cancers, meaning that there is a good rationale that you could use a given drug for a treatment, but obviously you don't have data to get that. And this makes everything extremely complicated because you need to fight with the insurance companies to find it. You are never on a sure foot to know whether it is going to work or not. And it makes everything much more complicated. You know, there are ways to streamline this also, to make it easier, to make it more accessible. But it's never easy. It's not easy because of the insurance companies. It's not easy because of the pharma companies that don't want to provide the drugs for that, or at least get a starting point, you know, at least try it in at short levels.
Well, let me ask you, what would make it easier?
Well, the answer is, at the moment, the way it works usually is that the insurance company says, you know, we're not going to pay for that because it's not proven. That could be the easiest thing, is to say, you know what, these are rare disorders, there's no way you can prove it, or it's extremely complicated to prove it, so we need to start with that, and you could get, you know, a certain way that the insurance company gets some leeway to actually be able to reimburse for these situations.
For an individual patient, yes.
Mm-hmm. For an individual patient, obviously.
So what would make your life or the patient's lives easier? What hurdle would need to be broken down?
Well, basically, it's financial. You know, it's the financial aspect. It's ensuring that the patient has access. It's financial mostly, but actually, this financial
somebody pays for it
blocks the access to the treatment because it's blocked. And again, we're lucky in Switzerland because usually I manage to get a drug to the patient, but that is after.
So let me ask you, because you say paperwork, and I think we're talking literally about paperwork, right? A lot is still analog on paper. So would it, and I think there is nothing in the short term that we need, somebody needs to guarantee the payment and that it's covered and that the patient doesn't need to pay it out of pocket. So would a digitized process where you have like a platform where you enter it and you get your feedback in 24 hours, I mean, would these things, like, because you said it's in the practicalities at the end, right?
That would help, but I think it's a step further before that is even more important. It's the way of how do you handle, and in this situation, rare disorders, how do you get access for that? I mean, the way it works nowadays in our country is that you ask to use a treatment, the insurance company tells you, oh, but we need to have data about that. And you send a manuscript or paper that exists that is sort of based on what you say. They come back and you have some health experts working for the insurance company that tells you, oh, but I didn't see the disease with the indication that you were asking for. I didn't see the indication for the drug with the disease you were asking for. And then you have to start explaining, no, but this is a rare disorder. You know, chances that it will be tested one day in that and that you actually get a phase three trial in that is extremely remote. And that makes it complicated. And I'm lucky enough, I work in a university hospital. So again, I'm not being paid by the number of treatments or by the type of treatments I'm delivering. So I'm trying to give the best treatment,
the right thing,
the right treatment to the patient without any financial incentive.
So what we're seeing a little bit with all the great progress, particularly in oncology over the last 20 years, let's say, you know, new proven treatments, the expertise has exponentially grown with us as doctors, but also for people like in these insurance companies, payers. I mean, they need to be able to catch up with the expertise that is out there and all the scientific publications and papers you mentioned. So I think some way to bridge that gap so that also on the insurers and the payer side, you know, they can be able to have that eye-to-eye conversation with you on some scientific data for the patient. I think there are some ways to do that, but I think we're seeing the need there that progress has been so fast, but you need to catch up with really understanding what that progress and the data are. So I think it's a nice segue to talk a little bit about research, because I think that's where your heart is beating a lot in clinical research and find those new treatments for patients. So is there anything around clinical research? I mean, part of the success of innovation was this very close partnership between people like yourself in academia and then pharmaceutical companies who are developing and discovering new molecules and then developing and bringing them to the clinics. So anything there? You already mentioned the great success with COVID and the vaccine development. Is there anything you would love to see perpetuate from that COVID example or anything else that you'd like to share from your clinical research experience?
Well, one of the big issues that you're seeing is that the, you know, the work is shared work. It's something that you work together with the pharma companies. I mean, obviously they come with a compound. There is a huge amount of work that's involved in, you know, finding the compound, testing it, validating the approach, validating the pharmacological formulation to be able to get it done. But then afterwards, there is also a very big piece of work being done by the physicians and the patients, obviously, because they recruit the patients into the clinical trials, they have to evaluate the patients and so on. And it's a huge amount of work that's being done in there that's usually poorly or incompletely reimbursed by the pharma company, especially once you start considering that once you have a compound that goes to the market, all the benefits are taken up by the pharma. So there is probably a point where maybe some, you know, joint sharing of the benefits should be in order and would or could make a huge difference for the patients. And I think this starts to be extremely important once you talk about drugs that become more and more costly for the general population. And it's a little bit hard to swallow as a situation when you're working in a university hospital, your salary comes from, you know, tax money, the hospital is paying by tax money and so on, and you're taxed the first time once, and then afterwards you still have to pay more taxes to get the drugs available for the patients.
Yeah, and I think, so maybe also to, as a reminder to the audience, not everybody is so familiar with the sequence of drug development, but I think the way innovation has occurred in the last 20, 30 years with pharma industry that really most of the drug discovery, some of it, the molecules was also done in academic labs, but I think then mostly the clinical development in humans was done in the private sector, just because on average, it takes 10 years and it takes $1 billion to develop one drug. So to carry that cost and the risk of the cost and the time was just, right now, until now, we did not have a good public model to do it and carry that cost and risk. And what I found amazing with COVID, that very rapidly there was public-private partnerships to share the risk and share the cost between governments and pharma. And and physicians playing the game as well. So I think I agree with you that has been an imbalance. It's not a broken balance, but it's an imbalance between, you know, pharmaceutical industry alone cannot run a clinical trial because they don't have access to patients. So they have it, it is a conditional situation, but somehow it doesn't feel fair. The return on the investments are only going into one partner of the equation, although there's physicians and hospitals and patients that contribute the same, but they don't get returns on that investment. So I think it's a great point. And thank you for the courage of saying this, Andreas, because I'm hearing it a lot in individual dinner conversations, but I think it's not hitting the headlines, that topic, and it should. We need to create new models. So thank you for sharing that.
But I think it's a good point to mention COVID-19 again, because that's also one of the portions or fields where this could change in the future.
Yeah. Yes, and I think it's a great blueprint, because sometimes we it's a challenge to think about new ways of doing it, because we have to have that imagination on how to do it. But here now we have a blueprint. We can just look, like, you know, it went with the NIH and FDA and EMA, and then I think there were 20 pharma companies that joined, and university hospitals and the WHO. So I think we have a blueprint there that we can look at. So I think it's a great idea. Andreas, maybe to close us off, you have always struck me as somebody living in the future. You always were the first of having the latest device, and at the time it was the Palm and whatever. So you are a digital native to some point. Is there anything that in that realm you think, you know, in our largely analog paper fax machines, etc., operating hospital system and healthcare, is there anything you would love to do if you would be CEO of a digital company? What is it you would do?
It's a tricky question, because I think I'm actually going the other way around with as I'm getting older, probably. And it's also a lesson of the COVID. I don't know if you remember, but during the first wave here in Europe, I mean, everybody was talking about, you know, seeing patients remotely via video conference and so on. And this has been part of the worst part of taking care of patients, having to do it over screen, not being able to be close to sort of sense the feeling of the patient and be able to sort of reassure them or move. And so I'm really going away from that. And I think it has really highlighted the importance of having this close contact with the patient and direct contact with the patient. Now, yeah. This for the patient side, and from the medical side, I think what I think is going to change quite a bit. I mean, obviously, artificial intelligence is going to make a huge difference in the future. I remember when I was studying, we were talking about this computer program that was sort of, and it was this big thing because it was able to think about 15 different differential diagnoses for a diagnosis. Mm-hmm, and the replacement, and we could play on it. Probably you remember very
now. Yes, yes.
Going on, and this thing has disappeared completely. So the reality is that usually the doctor, the two or three different options that the doctor thinks about are the correct ones, and it's extremely rare that you actually need to have a big computer that helps you out.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of different things that can be done with artificial intelligence, and it's probably going to be able to guide us much more precisely in managing the patient, in, you know, looking at tiny details, helping us out, detect small things to make sure that we do everything. But at the same time, I think what I have learned lately is really that this is never going to replace a good doctor.
Yeah.
Or a good nurse, actually, and we are still going to have our job is probably going to change amazingly in the next 10 years. And I think the most important that we're going to get is really our personal contact that we keep with the patient. This is the one thing that's not going to be stolen from us, I think.
Yeah. And I think somehow, so thanks for clarifying that dichotomy. So one is the direct patient contact, which is with telehealth, and you can have a personal opinion, yes or no, and then it's also hybrid, right? For certain visits it's maybe good enough, and for others it's not enough. But then there's the whole data side, right? It's the data processing that, to be honest, takes a lot of time, redundancies, and cost. I mean, it just costs an amazing amount of money that we then don't have to afford new medicines for patients. So somehow the money is wrongly distributed in the system. I think digitization can help. And I love your idea even about AI and helping with differential diagnosis and just kind of whenever the human brain can't comprehend so many information at the same time, that's where I can help, but it won't replace the doctor. So I like that. And I think the book by Eric Topol on deep medicine, that's what he's saying. It actually brings back the human touch because you can put all that paper and administrative work to the computer and then focus on the patient. Anything you wanted to share before we close today?
No, thank you very much. It was a very interesting conversation and it was a pleasure being with you.
Thank you.